70 year old man, $100 bill man, founding father with a plan. He's going to Paris, the city of lights. Gonna get the French in on the fights. The fight for life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Gonna do all this despite his crankiness. Get him in on the rumble. Make the red coats tumble with French hate. We'll do our part.
Forgive me, my thoughts are elsewhere.
Ooh. What is her name?
America, sir.
$100 bill man will sit back and fire. No Franklin, founding father. The British say he's a father. Ben don't mind, he don't care. Like the French dames who shave down there. Yeah, he's swimming in pus, helping himself to that French kush. American horn dog, diplomat with a big heart. He's got that electric heart, and he's keeping this revolution on the clock. And he's swimming in pus, helping himself to that French kush. American horn dog, the blowman with a big hog. Zip-zap, he's got that electric cock, and he's keeping this revolution on the clock.
This is the Extra Hot Great Podcast, episode 507 for the week of April 15th, 2024. I am founding farter David T. Cole, and I'm here with coiffure of independence, Sarah D. Bunting.
Your mom's a land ho.
Canadian Martin, Tara Ariano.
I also spend all winter sleeping.
And Marquee Makeover recipient, Crystal Farmer.
How do I look?
Welcome to anyone who's still here after their minds were blown by that opening original rap by David T. Cole. Thank you so much.
Wow.
Welcome to Extra Hot Great for another week. Joining us, she is a podcaster. She's a basketball fan. You've heard her with us before. It's Crystal Farmer.
Thank you so much for having me.
We're thrilled to have you to discuss Franklin, in which it's December 1776. America has declared independence from Britain, but the war for independence is going very badly. What to do? Well, send Benjamin Franklin, Michael Douglas, to France, along with his grandson Temple, Noah Jupe, to raise money and support for the American side. It's a highly secret mission, so here's hoping Ben doesn't screw it up by being too horny. The show was based on Stacey Schiff's nonfiction book, A Great Improvisation. It was adapted for TV by Kirk, previously wrote on John Adams, and Howard Korter, previously of The Right Stuff, among others. Three episodes dropped on Apple TV Plus last Friday. We got the whole season. Anyone who watched ahead will be mindful of spoilers within reason, since this is based, of course, on historical events that probably really happened. Let's do the Chen check-in. Crystal, should our listeners watch Franklin?
No.
Sarah.
Well, it's no turn Washington spies. Just kidding. Yes, but is my answer.
Dave.
No, until the sixth episode where it turns out that Franklin. I may have to delete that. I'm not sure where we are.
Yeah,
in the timeline.
No, you will. It's a no for me as well. Holy moly, what a boring show.
It's so boring.
It's so boring.
It made me wish America was never born.
Let's get into the complaints. I do, Sarah, by the way, have a question about turn, so hold up for that. Are these the worst credits we have seen on Apple TV Plus? Yes, I am including the bouncing dots of the morning show. Crystal, what is your reaction to those credits?
I actually think the credits are like the only thing I actually liked about the show.
Okay, fair.
They felt very like whimsical. And so I was like, oh, fun. There's going to be, you know, some intrigue, some, you know, statecraft or whatever. And it was just not that. Like, it was just so boring.
It was from a different Franklin show we didn't get. Actually, it was from the Franklin we got in the John Adams miniseries. That's the credits for that Franklin, not for this Franklin.
It's not that they were bad. You're right. It's that they don't match the show that we got, which is extremely not fun. So I guess the theory behind adapting this specific period of Franklin's life is that even though we know how the American Revolution came out, it is important to dramatize the struggle that went into it. But is there enough struggle, at least in these early episodes, to convey that? Crystal, we'll start with you.
I mean, you could probably see me shaking my head no, because like the issue, I mean, obviously, like you were saying, it's based on historical events, and we know that he was in France for like almost a decade. Mm-hmm. And so obviously the show is not going to be like 10 years long.
Yeah.
So I just don't know why.
Just feel it, like it.
Exactly. Yes. Like, I don't know why there wasn't some attempt to like compress some of that time to make the show more watchable. Like, yeah. The thing that I just kind of felt about the show is like, it just felt so inert. Like, it just felt like nothing was happening, even when, like, there were actual, like, meetings between very important people and stuff. It just felt like nothing was happening. And it was happening, like, very slowly in very blue, like, settings. I just did not love it at all.
Yeah. I mean, Sarah, you brought up Turin already. The spies seem more compelling to me than any of the other stuff we see, which is, at least in the first, I'll say it, two episodes that I watch, is a lot of like eating rich food that's bad for your gout and flirting with ladies. There, we do see spies kind of around the fringes. I know, however, that TV also tried that already, and I didn't want to watch it then. Sarah, you did. How does this angle on the era work for you as a companion piece to Turn on AMC back in the 2010s?
Your favorite show ever.
Yeah.
Yes, my favorite show ever. You know how I love a reversed consonant in a title card. Mm-hmm. The credits did remind me of Turn, actually, and I think that it was like Monty Python's Turn, which is like, okay.
Foot coming down. Yeah.
Yeah, because exactly, that's what I feel like the rest of the panel hoped for. I also watched Sleepy Hollow, which their concept of Ben Franklin was that he was this like demented nudist.
Sure.
Who was like out in his yard flying kites in the buff, probably baked or like ate some weird mushroom from the forest and was like, well, it hath not killeth me. And played by Timothy Busfield of all people. So like for whatever reason, I'm your like revolutionary drama stan on the panel. I don't know how that fucking happened.
Yeah.
But it occurs to me, having watched all of this, that like Franklin, and I like Michael Douglas's performance a lot, actually. He's clearly having a ball, but it strikes me that this character is like so outré, like even based on what we know historically, this is such a big, unbelievable character that he's best as like, occasionally he wanders through the back of a shot wearing nothing but a kite, and then you just don't deal with him. But like all Franklin all the time, you'd think it would be too much, and it sounds like for everybody else, it was not enough. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to keep watching it, but I think for a certain kind of turning into their own grandfather viewer like myself, this is good stuff. As usual, it looks expensive, but as usual, too slow and doesn't necessarily know which characters it should be following. But like, I did kind of wish like this has been gone over, this content. So like find some spy tradecraft, some angle, something that's not the kind of same carefully self-important version of these tales that always seems to get told again instead of something new.
Yes. Well, the carefulness is like, that's part of the Apple TV remit as well, I think, where it's like, we don't want anything to be too upsetting. And this is the problem that we had with Manhunt, which we talked about on the Patreon a few weeks ago, too. Where it's just like, what angle are you bringing to this that's gonna, you know, illuminate anything in a way that feels relevant or interesting in our current day? And like, this is not it. Like, the other thing that it has in common with Manhunt, other than it's historical and about America, is that it's taking an angle on like what fame meant in a different period, because we get that moment of, you know, everyone is running along Ben Franklin's coach at the very beginning, and I thought it was because they were all beggars, and then it's like, no, they just know who he is, and they're like, they're stans.
I was like, really? Would these people know who Ben Franklin is? Like, these French, like, countryside people or French Parisians, would they know at this time?
I mean,
time?
He had merch, so I guess, but like,
he was setting up a merch table. He got out of the coat, set up a merch table.
If you didn't see episode 2, you missed the merch.
Check out my latest phonograph.
But then he gets out and he like quiets the crowd, and it's really funny because there was sort of a viral clip of Anne Hathaway a few months ago, like doing a similar thing in Italy, which we'll link in the show notes, that just struck me. But anyway, I just feel like fame is not that interesting, and this show doesn't, I think, have that much to say about it. I don't know. Did anyone disagree?
Well, I mean, on that front, I think the issue that I had with the Michael Douglas thing is kind of where Michael Douglas as Ben Franklin is kind of part of that. Like, I feel like some actors, you like watching them because they're able to kind of like disappear into their roles. They can like transform and be whatever. I think that was what Paul Giamatti did in the John Adams. Like, he was able to, like, you know, we weren't thinking about Paul Giamatti in that when I was watching it. But like, some actors, they're just always themselves. And that is what's compelling when you see them in certain roles, like, I don't know, Samuel Jackson or like Tom Cruise, like they're just always themselves. And I feel like Michael Douglas has kind of aged into that. And so when I was watching it, I'm like, I'm just watching Michael Douglas. Like, this is not really, he's not really doing anything. Although I do think like his persona does kind of lend itself well to like what we know about Ben Franklin, like Sarah was saying about how like just like kind of out there he was and what he was getting into. But like, I just felt like I was watching like Michael Douglas in like some kind of school play or something. It just felt very, I couldn't disappear. He didn't disappear into it.
One of the things that made it feel like a school play to me was sort of the, like the emotional compression of that character. There's no like real highs or real lows here. It's all sort of mid. Like, he never really gets fucking angry. Like, for a man that's on a mission to save the fate of a nation, and there's people being killed near him once in a while, there's, you know, the French working against him in certain quarters, all this sort of stuff, his fucking pain in the ass grandson's doing shit behind his back, and that has consequences. I just wanted
the
more.
Natalie Merchant of French diplomacy. America, sir.
I wanted more. Oh my God, that was the worst.
Jesus Christ. I wanted more what we saw with Tom Wilkinson's take on John Adams, which was, and even if it's inaccurate, I don't care because I'm here to be entertained, but like put a little passion into it.
Yeah.
And he didn't, but, and also he's like very monotone in this endeavor as well. Like, he actually doesn't even raise his voice that much, never mind the emotion behind it. So I thought it was just a weird choice, and it sort of sets the tone. And after three episodes, it didn't feel any different from end of episode three than it did from the start of episode one.
Well, speaking of things we wanted more of, and perhaps to be louder, most of the reviews I read mentioned Franklin's farts as a plot point, but based on what I saw, that was only in one scene. What the fuck? Yeah. Dave, your thoughts?
Oh, I've watched three of them. I watched the last one this morning because I got up early, and there is just the one fart. I think maybe those reviews are, I didn't know that about him.
Right.
And now I do, and I find that funny. I want to mention it. But when you're a student of this part of history, and by this part of history, I mean farting. Yes. You know that Ben Franklin was a fart.
Right.
Sarah, this is an emotional issue for you as well. Please speak on it.
I found the farts credible and believable.
Old man farts are dangerous stuff.
True.
Yeah.
Especially ones with gout.
The opening of an old man ass. Look out. It will change history. Because I have spent enough time with this in like scripted TV land, I just kind of feel like with Turn, there was a character, I forget exactly which figure it was, maybe Benedict Arnold? This was pre 1776. And the show understood that that character was like becoming more interesting to the viewer than whatever was going on in the foreground with Abe and his stupid dad. So they kind of shifted attention to that character and that actor thanks to his charisma. And I'm wondering if they shouldn't have tried doing that here a little more with whoever the actor is who's playing Lafayette.
Oh, that's our friend Theodore Pellerin from On Becoming a God in Central Florida. That show from a few years ago.
Like, the character as portrayed was like actually kind of annoying, but that was like interesting. That's something different, that Lafayette is just like a, you know, privileged sort of entitled brat at times, but also very watchable. I understand the show is called Franklin, and you've got Michael Douglas playing him. But again, it just comes back to that a little Ben Poots goes along with me. And if he's not going to be farting constantly, I have to agree. Shift the focus to other people who have a little more to tell us.
Yeah, I think all of the French characters were much more engaging than any of the American characters in the show.
Yeah.
I was looking up the Beaumarchais. I was like, why does that guy look familiar? And he played, I can't remember the name of the character, but in Bad Sisters, he was the, like, friend. I don't want to spoil like his turn in the series. But Asad Boab is the actor's name. And I remember looking him up after that show and being like, I can't wait to see what he does after this. I know he's also in Call My Agent as well, but he was really engaging. The actor who played the Comte de Vergin, is that how you say? I'm really bad at French. Yep. I studied Italian. He was also very like watchable. And so I just felt like everyone else was giving performances that were much more, I was much more interested in. And I don't know how much of that is like the Michael Douglas of it all and how much of it is that I'm just not as familiar with that side of this part of the history. Mm-hmm. I was like, oh, I want to see what they're up to. Let's follow them a little more than, you know, Temple or whatever he's doing.
I wonder if they just simply framed the project from the get-go. I don't mean as marketing, but from the get-go as Franklin in France. Mm-hmm. So you're not expecting to get a biopic. You're just getting this like, what the hell did he do in France and how did it save America or something? You know what I mean? That could be like the subtitle. What the hell was Franklin doing in France and how did it save America?
Yeah.
Eat, pray, fart. 18th century.
But frame it that way. So you're giving yourself permission to make it more of an ensemble, more of, you know, to play with the format. If you're going to do 8 episodes, there's no reason why you can't have Franklin just bookend a couple of them and then you're off to the Better Call Saul races, you know, with some of these. But they didn't. And Douglas doesn't carry the show, unfortunately. It is time to go around the dial talking about what we've been watching on TV lately. Our first stop with Tara.
So back when Loot first came out in 2022, I watched the first 3 episodes in which Molly, who's played by Maya Rudolph, finds out her billionaire tech bro husband, John, played by Adam Scott, whom she's been with since they were both in college, is going to leave her for a much younger woman. And so Molly takes her assistant, Nicholas, Joelkin Boosther, on a trip around the world, getting extremely sloppy in public. And then Sophia, Michaela J. Rodriguez, the head of Molly's charitable foundation, calls her down to their office to ask that Molly stop doing things that get her in the news for embarrassing reasons because it reflects badly on the organization. And Molly decides that she's going to start coming into the foundation every day as if it's a real job or something, even though she doesn't know what she's doing and no one particularly wants her there. Molly also describes her participation in the foundation's projects and advocacy on behalf of disadvantaged people entirely in terms that center herself, as if nonprofit housing initiatives and arts funding exist primarily so Molly can give her own life meaning and confirm for herself she's a good person, despite circumstances that have made her extremely isolated and out of touch with people who are not also rich. And that's where I stopped watching. But then I told my editor it cracked. The second season was coming up and he said he wanted me to review it. So I had to watch 2 full seasons in about 3 days. And that was a mistake. So the first season finale ends with Molly telling a room full of rich people at a Davos knockoff symposium that billionaires shouldn't exist. And she's going to spend the rest of her life giving away all of her money, which is a good start at the end of a season where we mostly saw her being a self-involved idiot. But then the season 2 premiere opens with her doing a 73 questions video for Vogue, where she talks about downsizing to a house that only has 5 pools and says it's so she can donate the profits from her first house's sale, though she does not say what she donated the profits to. Nothing else that happens in the episode suggests that since we saw her last, she's really been doing anything at all to make good on her pledge. In the middle of the season, she, for example, gets in trouble at a mall and gets out of that trouble by buying the mall. She says she's going to use the mall to give people jobs. We never hear about that again either. Even though the main project that the foundation undertakes in the second season is to buy a bunch of old hotels and renovate them for unhoused people to live and receive relevant services in, none of these clients ever gets a line to describe their own lives. I think maybe I saw one scene where there are possible clients in it as extras. Definitely, I'm not sure about that. The reason is, in the show's conception, the person who is actually benefiting the most from all of this charity is Molly, still, after 2 seasons. And so there's definitely a show to be made about a really rich person trying to figure out what she's going to do with her life after her main job of propping up her partner who made all their money disappears. And it would be so much more fun if Molly had just been allowed to keep getting into embarrassing situations. Not just more fun for me to watch, but more fun for Maya Rudolph to perform. We know she could do it. Dickinson, because of its setting, could conceal its more emotionally contentious material behind its period trappings. Mythic Quest has a powerful enough showrunner to keep it prickly, although that one is starting to fall off too after the last season. But every other Apple TV Plus comedy I've watched has in common a real need not to put its characters into any real distress or up against any real villains, and by extension, not to expose its viewers to any bad feelings either. And this is not to say unhoused characters, if we saw them on Loot, would be villains, but it would remind the viewers that Apple TV Plus wants to keep happy and comfortable and spending lots of money on Apple hardware, that there are people who actually have hard lives, even harder than Molly's. Instead, Loot can refer to people living in poverty as having been helped by Molly while keeping them completely off screen. And when I tell you the show was co-created by two Parks and Recreation writers, that should give you an idea of how nice they want everyone to be. So, long story short, Loot is bad. It's kind of actually immoral in its basic conception. No one should watch it. I'm shocked they made a second season. For more on this, you can read my review at Cracked. I really hated it. It made Love me it. Very mad.
But it does seem like a 2024 Read the Room problem.
Oh, yes. Yes.
We as a culture are sort of examining the ultra wealthy and wondering, because they exist, what does it mean for everybody under them? Like, these are the questions going through the culture right now. And the fact you're playing on that for laughs, it's a weird time to do it.
Right. It's like they got far enough to be like, people are mad at billionaires. And then they didn't think any further than that. They're like, that would be a good topic for a show.
Yeah. Billionaire rehab should not be a genre.
No, exactly.
No. Especially not on Apple TV. Which
exactly.
Like, you also make the morning show. These two things can't be together. I'm sorry.
All right, Crystal, what have you been watching recently?
So after or around the holidays, when I was home visiting my family, I saw someone tweet about a show called Carol and the End of the World, and it's on Netflix. And so I watched the first episode and I found it so like moving and like kind of weird and quirky that I was like, I can't watch this right now. It's the holidays. I want to be like in a good mood, right? So I didn't finish watching the rest of the season, but I did like the first episode. And recently I was like, trying to find something to watch on like a weekend or something. And I was like, oh yeah, I never finished that show. And so I picked it back up again and I really liked it. So the premise is Carol, played by Martha Kelly, the comedian Martha Kelly, who people might know from that Galifianakis show Baskets. She plays a woman named Carol who is like middle-aged. She lives alone and she's kind of like aimless. Also in this world, there is another planet that is about to collide with Earth in like a matter of months. So everyone else basically has been using this as an opportunity to do all of the things they always like wanted to do in their lives. Like her sister is very like adventurous. And so she's using these months to like travel around the world. And like her parents are like finally letting all their inhibitions go. Like they live as nudists and they're in like a throuple with the father's like personal care attendant. And it's just very weird. But Carol, she's kind of frozen. She doesn't really know how to make the most of like these last few months. And over the course of the show, we kind of see her like take small steps and then like bigger steps to kind of figure out like a way to make the last few months on Earth enjoyable, fun, like interesting for herself. Part of the reason it works so well is because of Martha Kelly's voice. I don't know if people are familiar with her, but she has a very soft, very kind of lethargic, like slow kind of way of talking. And I find it really like soothing, but it works completely for this character and how she is supposed to be kind of just very like turned in to herself and not really sort of open to the world.
Yeah, I need to get back to it. I watched the first few and then sort of fell off also over the holidays, but I agree. It's really funny to have this apocalypse idea and then center a person who's like, I just want everything to be normal. Like, I don't want to wild out. I want to have somewhere to go every day that makes me feel like things are still the same, which is, you know, really relatable, more so than the person who wants to go skydiving every day.
Exactly.
Is there anything you want to plug?
Yes, you can check out my podcast, 2 Cents Plus Tax. It's kind of on hiatus right now, 2 Cents Plus Tax podcast.com. You can also follow us on all various socials, on all of the podcast apps out there. Let me know if we should start doing it again. We haven't done it in a while. So it might be fun to sort of check back in with everyone.
Sarah D. Bunting.
Hello, I am here to talk about the quote new season of Top Chef, which I kept meaning to do. And then now it's like 5 weeks into it. But anyway, it's actually better because I think we have a better sense of the new season now that it's a handful of episodes old. As predicted, the new host, Kristen Kish, is really good. Clearly thrilled to be there. Thrilled not to be cooking, but judging and tasting instead. do not blame her. She's a smart judge, compassionate. But as time goes on, I hope she will push back a little more confidently on some of Tom Colicchio's more curmudgeonly takes. Having Kristen as the so-called face of the show does create a different vibe from the Padma era. It's not better or worse. It's just different. And it is tempting to link that with the somewhat baggy, tentative, I'm not sure what word I want exactly to describe the way episodes are hanging together in this Wisconsin season, which is to say, not as well as in the recent past yet. There was a recent Frank Lloyd Wright-based challenge brief that was, at best, tortured and confusing. The chefs clearly had trouble articulating it to themselves or cooking toward it, with, like, one exception. The editors also seemed to struggle a bit with how to shape A, an episode theme that wasn't thought through, and B, a conflict slash outcome that was evident from the first ad break, so there was, like, no suspense no matter what they did. And then Last Chance Kitchen also feels rather ad hoc. The first chef testant eliminated this season just straight bailed. Nobody involved can seem to agree on social media what the official story is. So we get a former pro golfer turned bedhead cutie Sue, which is fine. I like Sue. The 16th contestant, I guess. He just kind of is steadily mushing whoever gets in his path at Last Chance Kitchen, so I guess this was the outcome the universe wanted. But it's Last Chance Kitchen. I don't see why you couldn't just be transparent about last-minute changes you had to make. It's not a court proceeding. No one cares that much. Just say that David didn't want to do it. No one wanted to see more of him in his stupid hat anyway. But with all of these nitpicks, I must say, even though it's still finding its feet a little bit in the Kish era, the show is still very watchable. I think it'll figure these little things out in time. Maybe Wisconsin wasn't quite the cheese buffet of topics that other locations have been in the past, but they'll get it together. I trust them. Speaking of figuring things out, if you have not figured out that I run a true crime bookshop, well, guess what? I do, and everything tagged as seen on TV is 15% off for like another 2 weeks this month. So get after that at exhibitbbooks.com. The cart does the math. And I keep discovering books that I didn't know got turned into movies. Sometimes this is sort of upsetting. Like the guy who was, it was a Law and Order episode about a doctor who was like basically impregnating all of his fertility clients with his donations. And then they turned that into a TV movie starring George Zunza. Ew. Yeah. Anyway, sometimes this is not information anyone wants, but it's information that could save you 15%. So if you see a book and you're like, oh, that was actually on TV and you have receipts, let me know. Reach out. I'll fix it. I'll save you some money. ExhibitBbooks.com.
Where the cart does the math. Speaking of true crime, coming up on Friday on Extra Extra Hot Great, we have Under the Bridge. You have a very short description of what we're in for, Sarah D. Bunting, crime expert.
Yes, it is the Rena Virk case from British Columbia, yes?
Yes.
Is where this occurred, and there was a book that came out, I think, 5 years after the case, which was from the late 90s, and this is starring, among other people, Lily Gladstone from Killers of the Flower Moon, and what's her face?
Riley Keough from Daisy Jones.
Elvis Girl.
always takes me a minute that I'm like, which Elvis Girl?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Hero of Song and Story, Elvis Girl.
All right, that is available to any club member. If you're not a club member, shame on you. Go to extrahotgreat.com/club to join today, and then come back right here next week on EHG Prime. We're going to talk about Conan O'Brien Must Go, and we're going to welcome back Will Hines for that one. It is time for the Extra Hot Great Canon. I don't know why I'm talking like this now, but I am. Deal with it.
Hey, boo-boo.
Hey. Presenting this week is Bezor Laura. Take it away, Laura.
Hi, Extra Hot Great. It's Laura again. I'm submitting Justified Season 1, Episode 13, Bulletville, to the Extra Hot Great Canon. I know I'm fighting an uphill battle because this episode has a mark against it by not containing Timothy off of his pants in a black short sleeve t-shirt, which is normally my requirement for a good episode. It also doesn't have Rachel, Tim, or nearly enough art, which isn't quite as bad as the black t-shirt thing. but it's still bad. And I hope we can get through this trying time together. It's really hard for me to not just turn this into a full recap because of how seamlessly multiple arcs get threaded together in this episode. Justified took some time to find its footing, but this season finale makes everything they've been working toward become clear. Yes, there are gunfights and bad guys and explosions, but it's the relationships that we need to be paying attention to. This episode highlights two father-son pairings. Bo and Boyd have been circling each other all season. Boyd trying to lead a more righteous life, but continually getting pulled back by Bo. Boyd's more righteous life is still lived in an over-the-top fashion, and his destruction of a truckload full of meth with a rocket launcher leads to a trail of horror that will ultimately drag Boyd back to a more criminal life again. Bo destroys Boyd's commune and then sends him away. At that moment, Boyd's silence to me as he walks away is more genuine than anything that could have been said. The man who always has words, maybe too many words, is so emotionally beaten down that he can't summon a single sentence. This devastation only worsens as he learns Bo has killed off all of his flock. The men hanging from the trees is chilling, and Boyd's words come back as he talks to God as he grieves for his men. This is maybe one of the few moments in the episode that comes close to not working for me, but if anyone is going to have a stylized conversation with God, it's Boyd Crowder, and if anyone is going to come close to selling it, it's Walton Goggins. The other father-son relationship is between Raylan and Arlo. Justified never shied away from the fact that most criminals are not that smart, and Arlo is a prime example of this. He thinks he can convince Raylan that he's turned over a new leaf and just wants to bond and reminisce when he's really trying to hand Raylan over to Bo on a silver platter. Fortunately, as always, Raylan is not just a step ahead, but miles ahead of Arlo. Clip one.
You should get married again. Not living like this.
What's going on, Arlo? Keep checking your watch.
Just wondered how long I've been a prisoner here.
That all, huh?
That's it.
We never had much in common, you and me, but that doesn't mean I don't have regrets.
Raylan's holding his gun up when Arlo turns around.
Put the gun down. When are they coming?
They're waiting outside. How long you known?
Well, Arlo, in truth, I think I've always known.
This isn't something I wanted to do, son.
No. But don't call me that. What's the plan?
For me to shoot you in the leg. Bo wants to take your life.
Then what happens?
In quick succession, Raylan shoots Arlo, disposes of two more of those men, and discovers he needs to sacrifice himself in order to save Ava. Then, for the first time in the episode, Raylan and Boyd are together, and for the first time in the series, they're paired on the same side. Their conversation in the car highlights the level of understanding between the two of them and the knowledge of their roles in the destruction that's already taken place and everything that's yet to come. Clip two.
Do you believe in God?
I do.
Tell me about your God, Raylan.
Well, you know, white hair, long beard, sits on the heavenly throne.
I set all this into motion, didn't I?
Actually, I think me shooting Tommy Bucks might have had something to do with it.
The two arrive in Bulletville, and we are back to family dynamics and the last conversation Bo and Boyd will ever have. Clip three.
Well, let's go see.
Raylan, I'm gonna need you to step away from my father.
Boyd? You don't want to do that.
It's not something I want to do, my friend. It's something I have to do. Step back, please.
You didn't come to save my ass, did you, boy?
No, Daddy, I did not.
You gonna shoot me, son? Did you?
Maybe.
It don't really seem right. I had a chance to kill you, and I didn't do it.
That's where you're wrong, Daddy. There's more than one way to kill a man. You can kill his physical body. Or you can kill a spirit within.
You gonna pull the trigger, or you gonna talk me to death?
The bullets from unseen shooters take out Beau, and even though Boyd was about to kill him himself, you can see it's still a devastating loss. He swallows his grief, runs inside, and then it becomes apparent what he, Raylan, and Ava have to do to make it out alive. Boyd being Boyd, there's still moments of humor, but four.
You didn't happen to bring your rocket launcher, did you?
I didn't think to pack one.
All we want is Raylan Givens!
I'm Raylan Givens!
No, I'm Raylan Givens!
You trying to be funny?
A little.
Get Givens, the other two can walk!
I ain't going anywhere, they killed my daddy.
You came here to kill your daddy yourself.
Well, that's different.
How?
You got to kill the two men who came after your daddy. You give me the same courtesy.
Why don't we all just run?
Well, someone's got to keep them here for the other two to have a chance. And if we all stay here, night comes, we're dead. Only one way this works.
I'll stay then.
Boyd, I'm asking you. Take Ava out of here.
And Boyd being Boyd, he doesn't exactly follow Raylan's instructions. He takes out the Miami cartel shooter before he can shoot Raylan. And even though you know it's unlikely that the show would have killed them off, it's still really hard until this moment to see how they'll get out of the situation. And just as you're acknowledging that, the episode ends with the most important relationship of the entire series, clip 5.
Is he dead?
Yeah, I think so.
Where's Ava?
She's running through the woods. Where are you going?
Going after the young lady with the automatic weapon.
I'll get her.
What are you going to do after you get her?
I ain't quite figured that out yet. You going to shoot to stop me?
Maybe.
I'm pretty sure you're empty.
You going to bet your life on that?
No, Raylan, I'm going to bet my life on you being the only friend I have left in this world.
As our first instance of You'll Never Leave Harlan Alive sounds its chords, Raylan makes his decision. He watched Boyd get in the car, slowly raises his gun, only to pretend to shoot as he lets Boyd get away. Though we've known Raylan and Boyd's history from the very beginning of the series, this episode is the first to really show us what that history means. Two men who had two bad daddies, whose lives went in two different ways, but always will have a deep, untying connection. They dug gold together. A connection that no matter what comes next will underline their interactions throughout the remainder of the series. That is why I'm hoping you'll induct Bulletville into the Extra Hot Great canon.
First of all, nice try with the rebrand. Bezor Laura, we know it's you. Thank you so much for that pitch. Crystal, you chose this from our list of submissions. Please start us off.
Yeah, I really like this episode. I was watching it this morning and I was like, do I really like this episode so much because I really love Justified, which I do? Or do I just really like it because I'm like comparing it to Franklin, which was so boring and bad? The thing I couldn't get over with this episode is just how like musical the dialogue is, like everyone sort of intercutting, not just the way that they talk to each other, but like the way that they speak. Obviously, Boyd is very like, he's very verbose and he likes to use a lot of like $5 words. And it's really fun to see, you know, when you have like his dad who's just like, I'm just going to shoot you. Like, that's what's going to happen. Yes. And he's like, okay, you're going to talk at me. I know, that's how it goes. But yeah, I chose this episode because I have not done a full rewatch of Justified like ever since the show ended. And I'm always like, I should do that because, you know, Timothy Olyphant and Walton Goggins have like not stopped working since the show ended. Like, they're everywhere all the time. The Shield and this like kind of vaulted him into like a different stratosphere as an actor. And I just really like the spin that he put on this character. I mean, there's some characters in this show that I just never vibed with. And Ava and Winona are like two of them. And I feel bad because I'm like, they're the women characters. But I think I felt that way because they really just never could figure out what to do with them. And I don't think that's my fault. I think that's the fault of the writers for never really giving them much to do. I think they obviously kind of fixed that in season two with introducing both Mags Bennett and Loretta to like female characters that I think are amazing and complex and interesting. But yeah, this show is really good. And I feel like Justified is one of those like it straddles that line between like peak TV and prestige TV, where it was sort of getting introduced right at the sort of tail end of prestige TV shows premiering and right at the beginning of like there being like too much TV to like really keep up with. And so I feel like it kind of gets forgotten. And so I feel like it should get a little more credit, I think, or you know, inclusion in that kind of peak TV grouping that it doesn't really get as much. And people always talk about the second season, but I think the first season and probably up through season 5-ish. I like the whole show. I'm not going to say it like one season was better than the others, but like, I feel like people always only talk about season 2 as if the rest of the show is kind of like a lower quality, which I don't think it is. But yeah, no, this episode is very good. And Bizarre Laura is right in that from the start, you get immediately the themes of like, okay, this is going to be about fathers and sons, and it's going to be about friendship. And I love friendship. In fact, I like wrote that in my notes in like capital letters when like Raylan and Boyd were like in the car together. I was like, oh, how sweet. Like, mm-hmm. I love them. Yeah, no, it's just, this is a really good episode and I'm interested to hear what you all think about it.
Sarah, why don't you go next? Because Dave and I have obviously watched more of this than you have.
Not for long, because coincidentally, Dan and I started not a rewatch because I've seen a few episodes here and there, but I like started Justified like a whole house ago, like 9 years ago. And then I was like, oh, I should stop watching this on my own because I think Dan would also like it. And Art is played by Nick Searcy, who is an old friend and colleague of my husband. So who I have met, nice guy, kind of Trumpy, which is unfortunate, but you can't tell that on screen and you forget all about it because Art is like a good character and he's a good actor. Anyway, I think we're like 8 episodes into the first season. And then I checked our doc for this episode of Extra Hot Great and was like, well, either we're going to like floor it and stay up until 4 in the morning watching to get caught up, or I'm just going to watch this finale anyway. And then go back and watch it again with Dan. And I felt good about doing the second thing because the show, like, I will be able to watch this finale again and still enjoy it. Mm-hmm. There are some issues here, I guess, like the black t-shirt thing. Laura's right. It's a problem.
True.
And Crystal, you are also right. Like, Ava, like from the halfway through the first season vantage point, the ability of the show to forget how prone she is to just fucking shooting people, like shooting the hell out of them. Uh-huh. Like, she is lethal. And the show's just like, huh, right? And you're like, well, but not, I mean, that's sort of fucked up. Like, you know, Raylan kind of doesn't treat her in a serious way. And it's like, she will kill you, dig you up and kill you again. I think the show never quite like figured out that this was not just some cutie who was hitting on him. Like, it's deeper than that. And they didn't quite get a handle, or they haven't yet, that I can see. I'd like Winona slightly more in terms of feeling like they had a plan for her. This is the first thing I've ever actually liked Natalie Zea in. I think that this show is really more about family and like the friendships, like the bonds of people who are kin but not blood, as they say in my Indiana half of the family. I think that this finale really shows all of the things that this show like has no business fucking getting away with, like these speeches to God and blood, and then MC Gainey being like, you're gonna talk all day, and he's like, no. And I mean, that MC Gainey, an actor I never enjoy, got killed in this episode. Canon worthy, thank you very much. Walton Goggins' delivery of "Tell me about your God, Raylan," is like a novel. Mm-hmm. And there's no reason that this show as written should work. Like, Elmore Leonard is good bones, but like for it to go on like this for 6 seasons and be compelling, it's impressive, I would say, that I saw this episode in the rundown doc and was like, well, I guess I'm going to have to watch it twice. Hope it's really good and not just good like I'm expecting. But excellent presentation. I think, Laura, you got to the things that are canon worthy about this episode. And I think it's fascinating that you went with this episode and not a season 2 episode, because Crystal is totally right. I think that's where everybody's sort of like prestige antenna point when it comes to this show. But I'm interested to hear what the rest of the panel has to say and see what we end up doing with the vote.
I'm sure I have said before, I'm like still waiting for someone to do either the season two premiere or finale or both for the canon. Perhaps it's going to have to be me. But this episode is also good as hell. And I think the first season, after the premiere, it takes a little while to kind of lock in. There's a lot of just case of the week episodes in the middle that just feel mm-hmm. like any other procedural and not like the show it's going to become. I think it's like, mm-hmm. I'm sure I've said this before too. It's episode 10 or 11 when you sort of see what they're going to be doing with Raylan and Boyd. And that all pays off beautifully in this finale. Laura is right about all of the different plot strands coming together in such an economical way that like doesn't feel contrived at all, and also serves the underlying themes, like you've said, of you have family and friendship, as Crystal said. And what's really striking in this episode too is that you get the two generations of like people who have known each other all their lives. There's a sit down between Bo and Arlo where Bo says, you know, they're strategizing about their evil plan. And one says, I didn't even write down which, because it doesn't matter. One says, you've known me 50 years. The other says, you think that ought to incline me to trust you more or less? And like, that's it. That's the story.
Yeah. And the other one's like, I don't know, actually. Right. I mean, yeah. I like
yeah. So, and it's the same thing with Raylan and Boyd, but also Ava. And I agree, they, you know, she was a moving target for the writers. She does, I will say, get two A++ outfits in this episode. And she comes out mm-hmm. first in like the flowery slip, plaid flannel and sawed off shotgun at the mm-hmm. beginning. And then later mm-hmm. in the like flowered pearl snap under a chevron, you know, ski vest, another mm-hmm. excellent look. Perfectly fitting jeans. But then we see when the three of them are hiding out, it's the same thing. Like the three of them have known each other all their lives too. And, you know, that's why you can get a line of like, where's Ava? She's running through the woods because she's lived here all her life. Like she mm-hmm. knows the woods. You don't have to worry about her. She's going to be fine. And that was very well executed as well. And everything Laura said is so true. Like every clip that I was going to flag, if she didn't bring it up, is a clip that she mentioned. I mean, when, you know, Arlo thinks he's being cute, turning around because he thinks Raylan's not paying attention, grabbing his gun and then seeing Raylan's arcing drawn on him. Like, it's just, it's so good. And this is the episode, I think, more than any other that just lets you know you're in such good hands for the rest of the run of the show, however long it is. That final shot of Raylan like drawing, and you know he could hit Boyd if he wanted to, but he doesn't, and that's the show.
He literally just says pew pew, pew. Also, mm-hmm. which I love. Yeah. But something that you said, Tara, reminded me, I forgot to mention that in the same way that the Sopranos like kind of makes fun of New Jersey mm-hmm. and that milieu, but from it sort of deeply felt familial fondness
yes.
place. Mm-hmm. This is, I think, what Justified is doing with Southern/Appalachian Kentucky people, that mm-hmm. there is a little bit of like, you know, hillbilly hayseed, ha ha, but it comes from a place of understanding and love
yeah.
of the region and the people that I appreciate as not being cheap. So mm-hmm. just wanted to mention.
It feels authentic in the setting. It doesn't feel condescending. And it also, there are so many moments where you can tell the characters know what people mm-hmm. think of them because of where they're from. And like, they use that as a weapon. They use it to their advantage.
Mm-hmm.
Let's put this to the official vote. Crystal, what say you?
I say yay.
Sarah?
Me too.
Tara?
Me as well.
Yeah. So that means Justified, Season 1, Episode 13, Bullet Bill. You are hereby inducted into the Extra Hot Great Canon.
Americans love a winner.
Yup.
And will not tolerate a loser.
Nope.
It is time for the winner and the loser of the week. Sarah has this week's winner.
The winner is everybody who loves that just randomly getting dropped in, because Cold Case, which is the show that it's from, is getting a reboot at CBS from original creator Meredith Steam. I'm not sure that this is necessary, but I do enjoy being like, clonk. So, and who among us, etc.
As a percentage, how many of the headlines for this story were, Cold case brought out of freezer.
Nah.
No, brother.
And who is our loser of the week, Tara?
Well, it's also CBS because they, over the weekend, aired the final show of Billy Joel from Madison Square Garden. But because the Masters ran long and they had to get to their local news, they cut it in the middle of Piano Man and people were fucking furious.
Where the hell's Davey from?
I mean, like, this is the reason you sit through a Billy Joel show is to hear Piano Man. Like, it's not because you want to hear In the Rhythm Middle of the Night or whatever that Rhythm of Jean song is. Like, this is his closer. Anyway, they're going to reshow it. They were very apologetic, and they should be. They don't need everyone on fucking Long Island trying to secede over this.
If you say that you want to hear a song from River of Dreams, you are lying.
Yeah.
Whether you know it or not.
Yep. Speaking of things you sit through just to get to the end, you know what time it is?
Is it non-regulation game time?
It surely is.
Hooray!
We are between game time seasons, which means we are going to play a non-regulation game time so that Dave can also enjoy the fun of game time as a player. Today's game is called Keeping Everything 100. As we all know, among the references most closely associated with Benjamin Franklin is 100, as in the denomination of American currency on which his image appears. So in honor of our lead subject this week, Keeping Everything 100. A lot of TV shows have numbers in their titles. I will read you the description for one of these shows into which I have inserted Ben Franklin. You have to tell me what the Franklinized version of the show is called, replacing the original number with his number, 100. So, for example,
okay,
in the new Netflix show from Benioff and Weiss, Ben Franklin is among the present-day scientists dealing with the unexpected fallout from the Chinese Cultural Revolution. This show is called
100 Body Problem.
That's right. Based on the three body problem.
Got it.
If you get it from the description alone, you get 2 points. If you need a hint, you can guess at every level, Sarah. I will give you star of the show. Then the question's only worth 1 point. So I have not included the following. Shows where the number indicates a sequel, like Planet Earth 2. Any puns, so there's no 100 All Mankind because of 4. There's no titles that are only a number, like 24. There's no titles that already have 100 in them, like the $100,000 pyramid. There's no Roman numerals, no Gen V.
Phew.
And no number nicknames like the Deuce. And these are all shows I know well enough not to have to Google them, which is why Three Body Problem was the example and not an actual question, because I wasn't totally sure what that one is about. So any questions for me?
No. No.
The stakes are, I will buy the winner a gift. That gift will be 100 of something, and we will report on that in a later episode.
Excellent.
Let us throw it to Picky to see who is going first.
We will start with David.
We will start with David. So our order is Dave, Sarah, Crystal. 33 questions and a tiebreaker. Are we ready to play Keeping Everything 100?
Yes.
Yes.
Yep.
Dave.
Mm-hmm.
Ben Franklin brings Poor Richard's famous wit to his job writing The Girly Show.
100 Rock.
That is correct for 2 points. Good job, Dave.
Nice.
To Sarah. Parents who pretty clearly hate each other raise their large brood of children, a pair of twins, a set of sextuplets, and Benjamin Franklin.
Parents who pretty clearly hate each other. Oh my God, wait. Ben Franklin. I'm not sure if this is right, but 100 is enough?
Do you want a hint?
Yes.
Your hint is Kate Gosselin.
Oh, what the fuck was this thing called? John and Kate plus 100? John
and
Ben plus 8? Thank you. I'll take it.
I guess I should be saying what the real shows are. Those were 30 Rock for Dave, John and Kate plus 8 for Sarah. On to Crystal. Raised on the cuisine of the 18th century, Ben Franklin has a hard time coping with the almost supernaturally spicy chicken wings this show requires him to eat.
Oh, is it Hot 100s?
It is Hot 100s, not Hot Ones. Back to Dave. Struggling young New Yorkers have to recalibrate their lives when their younger brother, Ben Franklin, achieves fame as a YouTube pop star.
The other 100.
That is correct. Not the other two, the other 100.
That was good.
I would watch that.
To Sarah, Ben Franklin lends his fame to this unscripted show about unusual real-life calls to emergency services after he gets briefed on what phones are.
Unusual calls, rescue 9-100?
I'll give you that. I have rescue 100, but yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Based on rescue 911. Back to Crystal.
Wouldn't it be rescue 100?
Yes, but...
Oh, yeah. I'll give myself a point.
Okay, good job, Dave. To Crystal, Ben Franklin is among the many young people who welcome MTV into his journey of underaged, unplanned parenthood.
Oh, 100 and pregnant?
100 and pregnant is correct, not 16 and pregnant.
Gorgeous. Gorgeous.
A pair of single women need a third roommate to keep their great apartment. Ben Franklin will do nicely as long as their landlord never finds out he's not gay.
100's company.
That's correct. Not Three's company, 100's company. To Sarah. Military veteran Ben Franklin raises two kids and tries to dodge the constant judgment of his overbearing Cuban-born mother.
100 days at a time?
That's correct. Not one. 100. To Crystal. Legendary lady killer Ben Franklin trades pamphlet publishing for jingle writing in this sitcom about living with his nebbishy brother and dopey nephew.
Oh. Oh, I didn't get it until the nebbishy brother part. I was like, Frasier? That doesn't have a number in it. And also, they don't live together at Frasier. It's 100 and a half men?
It's 100 and a half men. That's correct. Not two. Mm-hmm. Returning to Dave. In a post-pandemic America, Ben Franklin thrives in a close-knit traveling theater troupe.
Station 100.
Station 100 is right. Not Station 11. To Sarah. Gout be damned, Ben Franklin gathers close friends and friendly colleagues for a freewheeling chat over a lavish shared meal.
Dinner for 100?
Dinner for 100 is right.
Thanks,
not five.
Piggy.
To Crystal. In North Carolina, Ben Franklin is forced to play high school basketball alongside his hated half-brother, which is a hassle because Ben Franklin is in his 70s.
Oh, brother. Okay. I think we've finally gotten to one I don't know.
There is a hint available.
Okay.
But you can put out a wild guess, right?
Oh, yeah. You can put out a wild guess, too.
Yeah, you can guess at every level. But I'm wondering, I'm trying to think. I feel like it's a teen show. Maybe I'm wrong. Yeah, give me the hint.
Your hint is Chad Michael Murray.
I knew it. I should have just said this. 100 Tree Hill?
That's right. 100
okay.
Tree Hill, not one.
Got it.
This is everyone's last question before the score break. Dave, Ben Franklin moves from Philadelphia to the Southwest to become a fire chief and proselytize about skincare.
This is 100 Lone Star.
That's correct. Not when nice. I won one. 100. Sarah. If you thought it was a stretch for Ben Franklin to play on a high school basketball team, just imagine how unconvincing he is as an undercover vice cop trying to pass as a 17-year-old.
Undercover vice cop trying to pass as a 17-year-old. Hint, please.
Come on.
Your hint is Johnny Depp.
Oh, 100 Jump Street.
100 Jump Street is good for 1 point.
That's good.
To Crystal, Ben Franklin brings his hard-hitting interview style to a news magazine that has long signified the end of the weekend.
Oh, 100 minutes.
That's right, 100 minutes, not 60.
Even more boring.
Let's get those scores.
Oh boy, pretty close game so far. I have 8 points. Crystal has 9 points. David T. Cole has 10 points.
Dave.
Good job. Back to it, Dave. Mm-hmm. Ben Franklin dusts off his low-rise breeches to reunite with the members of his old pop group and go on tour again.
Girls 100 Eva.
That's correct. Not Girls 5 Eva. Girls 100
Eva. I would watch that.
I would too.
Sarah D. Bunting. Though this sitcom is primarily about a mousy girl and the borderline sociopathic neighbor mentioned in the title, Ben Franklin also delights viewers playing himself.
Don't trust the Ben Franklin in apartment 100?
Sure. Not apartment 23 this time. To Crystal. In suburban Wisconsin, Ben Franklin blows off his few responsibilities to hang out in his best friend's basement and get high on hemp.
That 100s show.
That's correct. Not 70s. 100s. Okay. Back to Dave. Ben Franklin has topical jokes to spare for this satirical news show, but his colonial American sense of humor doesn't always mesh with those of his Newfoundland-bred co-stars.
Okay. This hour has 100 minutes.
That's correct. Wow. Not 22.
That's some nice Canadian content for you. Mm-hmm. If you don't know what the hell that is, mm-hmm, I don't blame you.
I actually would have gotten that one, but I'm glad I didn't have to answer the real one because I got the number of minutes wrong.
To Sarah, at the tender age of 70-something, Ben Franklin has to step up and look after his younger siblings when their parents are orphaned in a car crash.
Jesus. Whole litter of them, too. Party of 100?
Party of 100 is right, not five.
Franklin family loves to fuck.
And fart.
Crystal, Ben Franklin's free-spirited attitude makes him a perfect pop star for the 1970s. Mining his life experience for songs, it also makes him very hard to work or live with.
Can I get a hint?
Of course. Already mentioned in this episode, your hint is Riley Keough.
Oh.
Elvis girl.
Who is she in? Okay. The book. I'm picturing the book, and I know it's the, and it has that guy who I hate.
I don't know what you're talking about, but I enjoy it. Who's the guy you
he's
hate?
He's like Sam Claflin. He's like wet bread dough. I don't know. He's so boring. What is the name of the show? Daisy Jones and the 100.
That's yes! correct. 100, yes. Not six. Good for 1 point.
I couldn't pull Jones. I was like, it's Daisy something. I know it's six, but dang, miss.
Back to Dave.
Yeah.
Ben Franklin.
Yeah.
Astronaut. A man barely alive. We can rebuild him. We have the technology, partly because he discovered electricity.
Okay, so this is... hang so on good. A sec. This is the $100 man, because it's $6 million we're replacing, right?
Sure. I have $100 million, but yes, you're right.
Well, you said the number. That's a number. $6 million is a number. So I'm more correct than you are, is what you're saying. All right. Bonus point for me, I guess.
Okay.
Must be nice to be in charge of the points.
I'm not, actually. It's just suggestions.
Mm-hmm.
Just remember who's editing.
Sarah D. Bunting.
Yes.
Ben Franklin takes a break from the important work of government to bring viewers memorable stories and biographies from the world of sports.
From the world of sports. 100 for 100.
That's right. Not 30.
Nice. Perfect.
Crystal. Ben Franklin is one of two adults playing a middle schooler suffering through millennial puberty in this beloved dramedy.
Okay, so it's Pen 15. Pen 100?
Pen 100 is right.
Nice.
Dave.
Mm-hmm.
Ben Franklin wrestles with the decision of giving up his various scientific and political interests to move back into his childhood home and join his family's funeral business.
This is a lot of work for a lot of men and women and machines.
Yep.
Is 100 feet under.
It is 100 feet under, not six.
I mean, nobody's getting at you after that one. Well done, Fisher family.
Journey to the center of the earth.
Seriously. 20,000 leagues under your yard.
Sarah.
Yes.
Ben Franklin is controversially judged hot enough to be featured on Bravo among this show's cast of messy, sassy realtors.
Oh, Christ.
Yeah. What?
$100 listing.
$100 listing is right. That's probably what passes cost in his day. Also,
True.
To Crystal, Ben Franklin has to learn about double the amount of dialogue he would in any other hour-long show to play the snuff-addicted co-writer of Los Angeles-based sketch show.
Oh, brother!
Oh, snuff like the stuff you put in your.
Yes.
Not he's addicted to.
No, not snuff
death
films.
And Got it. Okay. I was trying to figure it out. I couldn't pull the show.
Wow, I'm really flailing here. I feel like I'm doing better on everyone else's questions. Can I get a hint?
Of course. Your hint is Matthew Perry.
Oh, is this show based in LA? Wait, no. It is based, of course, it's right in the friggin' name. Studio 100 in the Sunset Strip?
That's right, Studio 100,
oh my gosh,
not 60.
Crystal. Uh-huh.
Dave.
Yes.
Ben Franklin is a perfect fit to join a quasi-Masonic social club with lots of ancient rites. Unfortunately, he joins when it is very much in its decline.
Lodge 100.
Lodge 100 is right, not 49. Sarah, after a young girl loses her mother, she makes a family from the two guys her mom thought might have gotten her pregnant, a cool bearded artist, and Ben Franklin.
And 98 other dudes, apparently. My 100 dads.
That's right. My 100 dads, not dudes.
I'm sorry. I had to like stifle myself from laughing because I was like, what a premise.
Yeah, oh, wow.
To Crystal, Ben Franklin rooms with his fellow diner server while they save up their meager earnings to start a cupcake business.
100 broke girls.
100 broke girls is right, not two. Okay, everyone has one question left. Let's get those scores.
Oh.
So, yeah, it's pretty close, but I think it's probably over also. Crystal has 17, I have 18, and David T. Cole, perfect score of 20.
Let's see if he can keep it going on a final question.
Come on, Tara. See if he can keep it 100.
Percent
correct.
Ben Franklin talks out all his thoughts and problems with his other neurotic friends, even though he aged out of the titular demographic decades ago.
All right, that's generic enough to make me worried about this answer, but I'm going to throw it out there. Mm. Is this 100-something?
It is 100-something. Good job.
30-something. Okay.
No.
Sarah?
Yes?
Ben Franklin ended his life by suicide. Oh, no. But he left behind a lot of clues for his high school classmates to explain how he arrived at the decision.
Wow, it's a lot of tapes. Is this 100 reasons why?
It is 100 reasons why, not 13. And finally, to Crystal. Ben Franklin patrols a New York City precinct and gets teased about the various possible titles of his sex tape, even though there's nothing Ben Franklin could possibly take more seriously.
Is it Brooklyn 100? Wait, is that wrong? Brooklyn 100. There
we
correct.
Go. There we go. And that's game. Let's get the final scores.
Final scores are Crystal 19, Sarah D. Bunting 20, and David T. Cole are victor with 22.
Dave!
That was a very funny game, Tara.
It was. Okay. Really good.
Do you want to play the tiebreaker for Steel Meal?
Okay.
Sure.
Dave, you can take a break.
Oh.
This will be for, or unless you want to play it and assign it to someone else. It's up to you.
That's what I want to do.
All right.
Okay.
Let me finish the whole question before answering, please.
Okay.
Ben Franklin and his twin sister experienced jarring culture shock after relocating from a high school in their native Philadelphia to one in glamorous Los Angeles.
Beverly Hills 100.
Oh, nice. Yeah. Yes. That's the winner.
Good
for
job.
Sure.
Dave. Thank
Dave.
You, Tara.
Good job, Dave.
You're welcome.
That was madness. Madness, I tell you. And that is also it for another episode of Extra Hot. Great. We adjusted our bifocals to watch the Apple TV biopic Franklin before going around the dial with stops at Loot, Carol and the End of the World, and Top Chef. Bezor Laura justified her pick of Bulletville for the canon. We crowned winners and losers of the week, and I was the winner of this week's Game Time from Tara. Next up, it's True Crime on Extra Extra Hot Great with Under the Bridge. Then back here on EHG Prime next week for Conan O'Brien Must Go. Remember,
we're listening.
I am David T. Cole, and on behalf of Tara Ariana,
I gotta go meet my 100 dads.
Sarah D. Bunting.
Maybe he's Batman.
And Crystal Farmer.
Chad Michael Murray.
Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time right here on Extra Hot Great.
How about what you do for me? Is you leave here and you never see me again. Let's start there.
All right.
Here he comes, the 70-year-old man. Founding father with a plan. The city of lights.
The French on the fights.
The fight for life and liberty and the pursuit of happiness. Get a dip on the rumble.
Make the red coats tumble.
With French aid, we'll do our part. $100 bill man, we'll sit back and fart. The British say he's a bother. Then don't mind, he don't care. He likes the French dames who shave down there. Oh, swimming in pus, helping himself to that French cush. American horn guard,
diplomat with a big heart.
Zip zap, he's got bad electric talk.